Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. For most of his career, David Simon has been digging into our most pressing urban issues: race, inequality, crime, policing. From his years as a Baltimore Sun reporter through The Wire and Tremé, his HBO series about New Orleans after Katrina, and now an HBO miniseries about a racial divide in housing called Show Me a Hero. It takes place in the 1980s in the working-class town of Yonkers, north of New York City. And David Simon is here in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What's your thumbnail description of Show Me a Hero that listeners should know if they haven't seen it?
I think it's the place where the rubber hits the road with regard to race and our racial pathologies in this country. We spent a long time arguing about whether or not we're a post-racial society before the last year came up on us and made clear that we are not in any sense a post-racial society. And there are these friction points that still exist for Americans. And one of them is about sharing geographic space and sharing power. And at a certain point, when the majority, white America, the sort of normative America, the America that seems to work or be connected to the economic engines, when that's asked to risk anything, almost anything, all hell breaks loose. And it's happened. It happens around the country. It's happened here in Baltimore back in the aughts, a decade ago, when they tried to do the move to opportunity in Baltimore County. And the same
from the Hud v. Thompson case.
When they were trying to move scattered site to Essex, take some low-income housing and scatter it around the eastern part of the county. You had the same political trauma. You have the same political trauma going on right now in Dallas. You have it going on right now two towns north of Yonkers, where Show Me a Hero is set, in Tarrytown. I mean, same county. Westchester County, New York, is still fighting the same fight, only two towns higher up on the river. We can't get past this. And this has been going on now for 30, 40 years after we've made the decision that, yes, everything we did in the previous half century was purposely to segregate the poor and segregate public housing by race. Willfully we did that as a plan. And so now anytime we try to remedy it in any sense, we go crazy. And that's what happened in Yonkers.
The title... Well, you took the title from the book on which this
Yes, year, Lisa Belkin's book.
A very carefully reported book. The title comes from the F. Scott Fitzgerald line, "Show me a hero and I'll write you a tragedy."
Mm-hmm.
So is there a hero in your story, or is it all tragedy?
They are, but they're all lowercase heroes in the sense of, and I'm not really particularly interested in uppercase heroes because I think a lot of our problems are systemic. And they're rooted in how we do business at this point, politically and socially and economically. And so I'm kind of down on the great man theory of history, that if we only elect the right guy or the pure of heart or the Lincoln-esque character, then we'll be fine. I think our political structures are now so compromised that I don't think the great man of history theory applies. Certainly didn't apply to Nick Wasisco. He came in...
Nick Wasisco was the mayor.
Yes, he was the mayor.
Who's at the center of the story you tell.
He got elected for running to the right of the incumbent mayor.
On the public housing issue.
Right, by saying he would more aggressively pursue an appeal of the decision. When, in fact, everyone in the city government knew that the case had been sort of rock solidly made by the U.S. attorneys and by the NAACP attorneys, and nonetheless, by offering the false hope of a more aggressive legal appeal, he won one election, and then almost before he was inaugurated, comes the phone call from the lawyer saying the circuit court, the appeals court, has refused to hear our appeal. It was a 3-judge panel; 2 of them were Reagan appointees, and we got to build the housing. And so then he had to turn around and tell the voters the truth. That he did tell the voters the truth and that he stuck by the truth even when it became incredibly hot and he became incredibly politically vulnerable for it was heroic, again, with a small h. I mean, he comes in with his flaws. He comes in with his false mandate. But when the world was watching, he did stand by the idea that the law is the law. And he stood alone for some of those hard votes on the council. And his story really was a political tragedy. Were some of the seeds of the tragedy of his own planting? Yes, I suppose they were. But there are other heroes in the piece. Some of the white residents who took the turn from being aggressively anti-housing to being good neighbors are depicted in Lisa's book, as well as people who never get any credit for being heroes, which are the government bureaucrats. If I say the word bureaucrat, a lot of your listeners are going to think, somebody just cakewalking on a public salary and not doing the absolute minimum. But actually, the people running the housing authority, the people whose job it was to make these scattered site townhouses work, to not have them become political footballs or become inner city projects of the kind that the 50s, 60s, and 70s produced. They did a great job, and they were very conscientious about it, about their thinking, about their forward thinking about public housing and about how it could work and how they could avoid the mistakes of the past. So the heroes are in surprising places in the piece.
That's writer David Simon here on Maryland Morning, 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his most recent HBO miniseries, Show Me a Hero, written with former Baltimore Sun editor Bill Zorzi. Are there lessons to be learned from Yonkers 25 years ago?
The lessons to be learned are apparent. We just refuse to learn them. The heaviest part of this fight was over 200 units of low-income housing scattered about on multiple sites in a city of 200,000 people. And the city tore itself up, went to the point of bankruptcy, went to the point of sustaining unsustainable federal fines for refusing to cooperate with a court order in order not to build those houses. Yet when the houses were built, they're still there. Those townhouses are still occupied. They're still in decent shape. They never became a source of crime. They didn't impair the real estate market. Was there some white flight? Yes, there always is. If you read a book by Andrew Hacker called Two Nations, Hacker uses all the social science research to show that at about 8%, 9% minority presence in a neighborhood or in a school, you start to get white flight. There are some people that if they can't be in a hyper majority, they're going to run. And there's nothing you can do about that if you believe in the idea of an integrated society. So there was some white flight. It tended to be more about, not about the townhouses, but about another component of the case, which was school desegregation. And it happened in Yonkers, and it's happened elsewhere. We never come to the conclusion that the evidence warrants, which is that if we would accept a little or a moderate amount of desegregation, if we would risk a little bit of the societal welfare so that the poor weren't hyper-segregated in these, in places like the high-rises here in Baltimore, that we used to have, or in the heart of East or West Baltimore, if we shared a little bit of our national dynamic, that people would have better outcomes. All people would have better outcomes. And that's actually been proven true. It was proven true in Yonkers. We just don't learn. We want to fear the worst.
We just don't learn. You say we're not learning lessons. Is that going to change as the demographics of the country change, as it becomes a more brown country?
Well, some people are learning it, and certainly there are a lot of people in Yonkers who learned it the hard way. Mary Dorman, one of the characters played by Catherine Keener beautifully in the miniseries, she began one of the most vocally aggressive opponents, and at the moment that she realized, oh my God, they're going to build the houses anyway, and these people are going to be my neighbors, and I don't want my neighbors thinking ill of me, so I guess I got to go welcome them on some terms. I got to figure out how to help. And she became one of the strongest proponents because she found out that a lot of the people were seeking the exact same thing that she was seeking, which was a home and a neighborhood dynamic. And so all of her greatest fears never materialized. And she, looking back over 20 years, I got to meet her before she passed away. Looking back over the 20 years after they built the housing, she was, to an extent, a little bit ashamed about how far they had gone in their reaction against it. I think that's exactly right. A lot of people look at Yonkers and they say, oh, well, it was 80-20 white. Now it's 56-44. Look, you're running the white. You know what? The New York metropolitan area as a whole is 40% people of color. The thing about integration is it's not there to keep places like Yonkers 80% white or to maintain a white hypermajority. It's there to help us orient ourselves to the fact, the real true fact, that we are going to become a more brown country. And we better deal with that in ways that don't destabilize neighborhoods and that lead to integrative logic. If we don't, what we're saying is more white-gated communities and more ghettos. And I don't know that that's the coarse and brutish country that we want. the inevitable future, the 21st century future, is, yeah, every place is supposed to get more brown.
I can't let you get away without asking you about Baltimore right now,
mm-hmm.
4 months after the riot on the day of Freddie Gray's funeral. Where do you think things stand? And did you expect the crime surge that we've seen since then?
I've expected a crime surge for a few years now. I'm astonished by how suddenly it began and how distinctly it began after the riot. But actually, I'd written something a couple, 2-3 years ago about how the deterrent against violent crime had been eviscerated. Right now, the clearance rate for homicide, which is mostly a black-on-black phenomenon in Baltimore, is like 35%. And that really means that by the time you shake it out in court, 1 out of 10 or 2 out of 10 people are going to jail for taking a life in Baltimore. And if you leave people on the street who are violent, eventually the next year you're going to have a 5-10% increase, and the year after that you're going to have a 5-10%. So I was expecting, there was a moment in the administration of Mr. Bernstein, the previous state's attorney, where he went from charging 130, 140 people a year for homicide down to about 70. And I wrote about that. And everyone sort of dismissed it as being, oh, well, he's not getting the quality of cases. And, you know, he's. But there was actually a change in dynamic where the state's attorney's office was less willing to risk anything but an easy case. And so they were putting people back on the street. The combination of the lack of deterrent plus this moment where the street cops step back. Clearly, they stepped back from the street as a means of protest over the indictments. I think it's led to this moment of realization on the part of a lot of people, a lot of the street culture, that there is no deterrent against violent crime. They're not locking anybody up when they kill somebody. And, you know, there are two things going on here now, one of which is the inner city, because the drug war has been over-policed brutally, and the poor have been over-policed by the drug war for the things that don't matter. For the things that shouldn't matter, for the things that we can't be jailing people for and ruining lives over, which is small-time drug stuff and street-level enforcement and failure to obey and loitering and all the things that were used by previous administrations to fill the city jail and to sweep the corners. That's led to an incredible alienation on the part of black community, and rightly so. They don't look upon the police as being the solution to anything because the police have been an army of occupation. And then the other thing is, when you really need the police to do what they can do well, if they're a functional police department, which is to police the real crime that makes a city neighborhood dangerous, which is to say, murder and shooting. If you're black and you're in Baltimore and you're the victim of a violent crime, the chance of it being solved is minimal. And that's been documented not just here, but around the country. Nobody cares. You know, nobody cares that the clearance rate in Compton or in Florence, California, or in West Baltimore or East Baltimore is 35%. I'm white. I live in Baltimore City. My chance of being the victim of a homicide is the same as if I lived in Omaha, Nebraska, statistically. But if I'm a young black male, if I'm a black male between the ages of 15 and 42, I think it's the second leading cause of death. And yet, we don't have a societal deterrent. So where they need police, the police are ineffective. And where they don't need police, the police are brutally oppressive. When I was in the homicide unit in 1988, the clearance rate was 72% for all cases. You know, I'm telling you right now, it's 36%, 37%.
A lot to think about. Thank you.
Sure.
Very much. Writer and producer David Simon. His latest TV series, available on HBO, is Show Me a Hero, about a brutal fight over desegregating public housing. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Also, more of this interview, some of Simon's thoughts about his audience. I'm Sheila Gast, ahead on Maryland Morning, student satirists here on 88.1.